I'm Sinan Aral, and this is The Digital Insider, where we get to the real hard science behind the digital economy and explore the latest trends in digital business and society with the world's leading thinkers and doers.
I think one of the things that organizations need to pay a lot more attention to, and those propagating some of these models need to pay attention to, is how are you going to create the trust that people are going to want to use your model? So if I'm going to create a new AI-powered customer care capability, leveraging the ideas framework from my company.
From the book.
Will customers trust it? Because the power of it's going to be my ability to provide deeper services that are more personalized to the customer. To do that, I need more data and interaction with the customer, maybe more continuously. I need to be more part of their life, so to speak. I'm going to do in-home grocery delivery or whatever it might be, through that type of experience. So I think I don't think organizations have really focused enough on that, gotten their mind wrapped around it. So we tried to focus a lot on that. That's one of the chapters near the end of Radically Human, and it was in the first book as well, is trust, I think, really becomes the differentiator. A lot of people say data's the new currency of the economy, or data's the new oil or whatever. I think it's trust.
Welcome back to The Digital Insider. I'm Sinan Aral. Before we get into today's terrific episode, I want to wish everyone a happy holiday season and let you know that this will be the final episode of season one. We'll be back with season two in early 2023. For our last episode this season, we're bringing you a fantastic interview with the Chief Technology Officer of Accenture, Paul Daugherty. Not only does Paul oversee Accenture's technology business globally and lead their technology and innovation strategy, technology R&D, ventures, and ecosystem groups, he's also a speaker, media commentator, and author. His latest book, Radically Human, How New Technology is Transforming Business and Shaping Our Future, received critical acclaim, and we had a terrific conversation about where technology is going today, in the near future, and in the distant future. If you've enjoyed listening to the podcast, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues so they can catch up over the break, and we'll catch you in 2023. And now please enjoy my conversation with Paul Daugherty. So Paul, thank you very much for joining us today. I am so excited for this conversation. It's rare to be able to speak to somebody with so much experience in organizational technology over such a long period of time. And you've always been a thought leader in this space. And so I'm really excited to kind of pick your brain a little bit about what I think and what I think you would agree is one of the most transformative periods for organizations and technology that we've seen in a long time. And that's saying a lot. But let's kind of like start a little bit more at the beginning. You've been at Accenture for 36 years. Is that correct?
Yes, that is indeed true.
And that's rare in this day and age to have that kind of a purview. I think it's fantastic. So you're the CTO of Accenture,
correct,
and 36 years at the organization. And so you have seen your clients experience nearly four decades of change in disruptive technologies, changing organizations, changing the nature of work. Can you start first to tell us a little bit about how you got to where you are, your personal journey? You went to Michigan, I think,
and then afterwards
you went straight to Accenture, and you've been there since. So tell us a little bit about, you know, where you were when you started and how you made this journey to CTO of a company with 721,000 employees around the world, which is huge company.
Staggering.
So
yeah.
Tell us a little bit about this journey.
Staggering even for me. It's like life in general, I guess. It's a lot of unexpected pathways along the way. I joined, as you said, out of University of Michigan, and really intended to stay a year and get some consulting experience and then go back to what my passion was, which was in the engineering college, studying computer engineering, specifically language theory and compilers and things like that in computer engineering. And I also had this interest that I'd cultivated in college. I took a course in cognitive psychology by a guy named Douglas Hofstadter, which we can get into a little bit later.
I never heard of him.
And I had these twin interests of technology and wanting to do research in technology, but also this with cognitive psychology. It kind of got me really interested in the human adaptation and human understanding and how technology and humans kind of came together. And But my advisor said, yeah, before you go back to a PhD program, go get some business experience. So I kind of went alphabetically. Arthur Anderson was pretty low in the alphabet at the time, which was the predecessor to Accenture. And I joined. Seriously, did interview some other companies, but joined Arthur Anderson, intending to stay for a short period of time and then go back to what my passion, which was research and teaching. But what I found somewhat surprisingly when I got out into the workforce and I worked for Accenture, was that the ability to apply technology and solve real-world problems actually got me to this nexus of technology and people that I really enjoyed, and I was able to work on exciting projects from the start. My very first project, I worked with Smalltalk, which at the time was very new, and looked at how we could apply Smalltalk in a very basic application of driver licensing to change the whole way you did software development in that kind of context. And anyway, that set me on the path. And then I was fortunate to have some great mentors along the way, and I kept deferring that PhD program still deferring it. We'll see. Maybe someday. You never
next
know.
Next year's your year, Paul.
We'll see. But what's amazed me, back to your point around, It was the arc of technology over that period of time, from punch cards and Fortran and things like that when I started, to one of my early projects was one of the largest DB2 mainframe database applications for a large customer service application at the time, and how the technology changed, the client server information superhighway that became the internet, and all these trends along the way, cloud computing, mobility, artificial intelligence. Now we talk about the metaverse. And it's just gotten more and more interesting and exciting to really look at people and technology and how they work together, and how we enable better outcomes for people, and how we really look at technology enabling better ways of doing business.
So in thinking about that and your experience and having seen everything from punch cards to Web3.
it's quite a spectrum.
Yeah, when you look at it from 30,000 feet, what are some of sort of like the lessons learned that are frameworks that stand the test of time with regard to how people and technology interact in a productive manner to sort of unlock the value of both the people and the technology, which in large part is a theme in your book as well, which we'll get to. But at the 30,000 foot level, having seen all of these clients over 40 years, what are some of the lessons that jump out for you?
There's a few of them that really stand out. One is as people and as humans, we tend to look at what technology can do today and not be great at projecting where it's going. And I think that's one of the things I've learned over time, spent a lot of time on in my role as chief technology officer, as we look at the vision and direction and trends and what we invest in going forward, is to look at where it's going, because technology, we all know the story, it's exponential pace of advancement, Moore's law, and these types of things, which we can get into more in terms of where that's headed. And I think as people, we tend to be short-sighted, though. We look at the limitations of technology today and tend not to really exploit the potential of technology. So that's one lesson learned, is you got to look at where it's going. Obvious point, but really hard to do. And that's where I focus a lot of the work and why I've written the books I have and work on the directions that we work
on. So technology is exponential and human brains are linear in terms of what they can see going forward.
And I think that's well understood now, but it's still hard to compensate for. So I spend a lot of time directing our Accenture research to look at how do we lay out those pathways? How do we make it understandable? How do we lay out the right decision frameworks around where technology is going and show the real power of it? So that's one thing. A second thing would be, how do you invest in technology? We've spent a lot of time on. So as a company, how do you do it? And how do you make the right investments? And how do you find a business case? Because you need kind of a business return or some sort of rate of return to justify investments. So that's another lesson learned. How do you do that with early stage technologies? And I think a third thing has been really how people in technology work together. When I started my career in technology, it was all about optimizing around the machine. We created the Y2K issue early on by taking the first two digits off a year to save storage space, because you had to optimize around what a computer could do. You weren't really thinking about the user experience that much and the human experience. But as technology has improved, one of the real fortuitous things has been we can optimize around the human capability. And again, I think we've been a little bit slow to realize that. That's what I've really focused on in the last couple of books I've written, is around how do we use the power of technology and the advances in technology to optimize for the human rather than just optimizing around what the machine and algorithms can do.
Yeah, I think there's so many good analogies that we've seen around that exact thing, and we're going to get deep into that in just a minute. But in thinking about your role at Accenture, CTO of a 720,000 person organization. Which technology trends right now do you think are going to be the most disruptive to organizations and businesses? And in like the next 10 years, say, what's the utopian scenario in these disruptions? And what's the nightmare scenario in these disruptions for organizations if they do adapt well and if they don't adapt well?
Yeah, I think the three mega trends that I really focus on, that I encourage people to focus on, are cloud, artificial intelligence, and the metaverse. And the way, and we're really early with all of them. It feels like the cloud's been around for a while, but we're really at the early stages of adoption, for the most part, within how organizations are truly using the cloud. You know, for example, would measure in the order of, you know, about 30 to 35% of enterprise workloads being the, you know, what businesses do being in the cloud today. So a lot more to potentially go as just with cloud. But if you think about it, cloud is giving us a new way to do business, a new way to leverage capability much faster and much more efficiently for organizations, and tapping into innovation much more quickly. And the way I think about it is cloud becomes the new operating system for businesses. You think about a new platform for innovation. So cloud is kind of that operating system and heart of the business. Artificial intelligence, the next megatrend on top of that, is giving us access to almost superpowers in terms of solving problems that you couldn't solve before in the old way of programming. And if we, as we look at the right way to combine human capability with AI, it really transforms the way you can operate and run a business. And so that's why that becomes exciting. And then the metaverse, broadly defined, and we have I have a broad definition of how I look at it, creates another layer of potential, which is reshaping human experience and the way we think about products. So if you take it together, like the cloud is a new operating system for how you support the foundation of your business, artificial intelligence giving you superpowers and running your business differently, and the metaverse creating a whole new realm of experience and products.
You know, I had a call with some of your colleagues on Friday, and they were explaining to me how all in Accenture is on the metaverse. So they were telling me that there are already 200,000 people inside Accenture that are dialed into the metaverse, using it for work purposes. You guys are onboarding new employees through the metaverse. There's socialization happening there as well as work happening there. Yeah. So tell me a little bit about what Accenture is doing, why it's so potentially disruptive for Accenture and therefore for other organizations, and what's sort of your detailed vision of the exact types of things that organizations can do with the metaverse.
That's a long one, so we'll kind of peel that one back.
Yeah.
You know, first, I think we have to start by reframing and defining what we mean when we talk about the metaverse, because I think the metaverse, the term is used so differently and so broadly by so many. So when I think about the metaverse, when we're talking about it, we're talking about what we call like the continuum of experiences that you can have in the metaverse. So it's not just about the consumer. It's about what you can, you know, in the consumer things you see every day, the Robloxes and these types of things. It's about, you know, how you can use it in your business.
My son's all over that, by the way.
I'm sure, you can't drag him out of it.
Yeah.
So the consumer and enterprise, and even an industrial realm of it too, when you think about digital twins, augmented work and such coming together, especially when enabled by new headsets that combine augmented and virtual experiences. But it's not just the experience element of it. It's the new technologies coming online. So the internet of ownership, as we refer to it, which is distributed ledger and related technology, giving us new forms of verification of identity, creation of products, et cetera. And as that technology evolves, it really does create new ways to create digital products that connect to your physical products, allowing you to engage with your customers much differently. Everything from cryptocurrencies to stable coins to fiat digital currencies enabled by the technology to fungible and non-fungible tokens, new forms of digital products. You take all that together, and that's a very big canvas of change. And we do believe it's transformational. I would say that the metaverse taken broadly will redefine organizations over the next 5 to 10 years, more so than digital technology writ large has transformed organizations over the last 10 or 20 years. And I believe it is that big of a transformation, because it's taking digital to the next, you know, to the really next stage of its of its advancement, and it's also transforming the internet in the way we connect and communicate across organizations in the context of
Which pieces of those are the most transformative? Is it NFTs and redefining digital goods and digital ownership? Is it the decentralized organizations, autonomous organizations, token-based voting? Is it the consensus mechanisms? Is it the augmented and virtual reality interactions? And you can say it's a combination, but it seems to me that some of those are likely to be very transformative across the digital economy. Yeah. Some of them sort of maybe less so. What's your opinion on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of the same story maybe that played out with Web 1.0. We talk about Web 3 now when we talk about the metaverse. If you think back to the 90s, I referred to the information superhighway earlier, when we didn't quite know where this internet thing was going to go. I think it's very early days for the metaverse now in terms of understanding where it's ultimately going to go. But I think you should look at it in three buckets. It's the consumer metaverse, which is where you create experiences like, as an example, Nike's done with Nike Land, where I think as of last count, they have 20 million consumers engaging, with their brand, their company, their products through Nike Land. That's an example of consumer, many other examples. There's the enterprise metaverse that you alluded to that we're using, which is using it in your business to transform the way you work. So we've onboarded 150,000 people in Accenture using the metaverse. Mm-hmm. We use Microsoft Altspace technology in our case, immersive headsets, and it was a research experiment before COVID, and we scaled it up because we had to find a new way to onboard employees when COVID hit. We're still hiring hundreds of thousands of people.
That was
a year.
An accelerator, huh? For a lot of organizations.
We had we had the research experiment. We said, well, what are we going to do? Can't get people to offices to onboard anymore.
Yeah.
So we changed our onboarding kit. We sent packages to the home and included a lot of things, including a headset. That's was the start of the onboarding experience, and it was tremendously effective.
How did the employees react to that? Were they happy, surprised, a little of both? Were they? What was their experience like?
The experience has been positive. We measure the engagement. We have neuroscientists looking at this, measuring the learning and retention that we get through it. It's been very positive, and that's why we scaled it. We kind of checked the progress, and as we were scaling and continuing, we kept scaling it up to the point it is today, and it's been very effective. And we're working with a lot of other organizations now to do similar things because even though you can get people back to offices, in some cases it's just a better way of doing some of the things we're doing in that context. I'll give you one anecdotal experience. I was talking to a new joiner in our office not too long ago, and I asked her, how was that onboarding experience? I was curious to get some real-time feedback. And she said, well, I was nervous. I was afraid to do this. I'd never done these kind of things before. I thought it was a gamer type of thing. And she said, but I tried it because my colleagues encouraged me to try it. So I tried it. And she said it was fantastic. She got in there and she described her experience. We provided some curated experiences as well as some discovery experiences. And she, loved it, learned about the company. Yeah. And she described, she was from New York. She was in the metaverse. She was in one of the unguided experiences. She met somebody from Denmark. She met somebody from Singapore, same type of job as her. They got to know each other. They meet regularly, monthly, back in the metaverse now.
Wow.
And I think that you think about that, the implications of that in terms of a organization like ours, where we pride ourselves in our global connectivity and culture and ways to bring people together in that sense. That's that's kind of beyond the expectations that we had for the technology. So we continue to experience good results with it. I think there's that possibility across other parts of the organization. We do a lot of client meetings in the metaverse. We've taken our board of directors to the metaverse. We hold management meetings. They are not exclusively, obviously, but we use it as an adjunct to complement and extend the real world experiences that we have.
So I want to switch a little bit to the book.
Sure.
And I also want to, get back to this analogy or to the point you made in the opening about how changing the way people work or thinking about changing work processes themselves is really the unlock for technology value,
right?
One of the major trends that you saw over the 40 years at Accenture. And so for those of us who study and work in technology are aware of this historical analogy to the electric dynamo replacing the steam engine.
Right.
And so for those of us who've done research on IT productivity and the impact of IT on organizations, know that at the turn of the century, the Industrial Revolution, We went from the steam engine to the electric dynamo, and there were factories all over the world, all over the United States, that had steam engines at the center of the factory floor. Yeah. And factories at the time were multi-layered. So there were, you know, 3-4 stories, and brought as many of the business processes as close to the steam engine as possible, because the steam energy dissipates very quickly.
Right. Right.
And so what happened at that time was they plucked the steam engine out of the center of the factory. They put the electric dynamo in. They turned it on. They were waiting for productivity improvements, and they waited and waited. And there were no productivity improvements for years, because you know, the technology wasn't delivering what they thought it should be delivering. And then they realized, wait a minute, so electric energy doesn't dissipate like steam energy does. We can now move each of these business processes, not so that they are maximizing the energy use by being close to the energy source, but we can arrange them so that their workflow is optimal. Mm-hmm. So we can go from a 3-story factory to a 1-story factory and lay out the processes in the order that they should be done, and have electricity power them all. And that's what generated the business productivity increases that the electric dynamo brought to the factory floor.
Yep.
And I think that analogy is apt, because it demonstrates that business process reengineering, complementary organizational investments, intangible investments that go along with the technological change are what create the productivity and business performance improvements. And in your book, Radically Human, which is a great book, by the way, I highly recommend people read it, you argue that organizations aren't being radical enough with AI, that to unlock the potential of AI, that they really need to do more in terms of these reorientings around human work. So can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yeah.
Because it's quite provocative, and what you expect organizations can achieve if they do that.
I'll do a little flash.
Fantastic. I appreciate you doing that. Yeah.
Of Radically Human.
Yeah.
It was really an interesting project working on the book. And this is the second book. The first was Human Plus Machine, which got into these issues, similar issues as well. And I think your analogy is apt back to the industrial age and the dynamo in terms of what the technology enables. And that's the point we're trying to make in Radically Human. As you said, organizations in many cases have been radical enough in applying the technology. And the other side of that is that more human-like capability and technology, which is what we're seeing with artificial intelligence, the metaverse, and robotics, and digital humans, and all these technologies that are floating around, is more human-like capability and technology, which really, rather than being a threat, as some people sometimes see it as, actually is the lever that unlocks the step change in human potential. So that's kind of the core thing we're writing about in the book. We talk right in the opening of the book about the research project that Jim Wilson, my co-author and I did, that led to, you know, the conclusions of the book, where before COVID, we had interviewed what we think was one of the largest ever studies of the use of technology in business. And it highlighted the fact that the top 10% of companies that were using basically the things that, you know, type of technology I talked about earlier, cloud, data, AI related technologies, more effectively, the top 10% in applying the technology were achieving gains of 2 times the laggards, you know, those that weren't. And that was surprising enough before COVID. Then when COVID hit, as we were coming out of COVID, we redid the analysis, and we saw that gap went from 2x to 5x. Now, in retrospect, maybe that makes sense, you know, because, you know, we all saw that COVID, you know, caused technology became the lifeline for companies to keep them going during technology. It was still surprising to see that stark of a comparison. And it was, you know, what we're talking about, which is companies that had that foundation in place could be more radical. We could onboard our employees in the metaverse because we had a little bit of an experiment going with it. One of the companies that we interviewed for the book and that we worked with had experiments around remote plant manufacturing plant inspection using augmented reality. Well, they could scale it and operate it effectively when the pandemic hit. And it's these types of effects that we saw. We also saw things like 63% of companies had first-time adoption of AI during the pandemic, which meant that, you know, if they were, if they weren't using AI, or they were 63% more likely to have taken it up during the pandemic. So there's this acceleration of the use of technology as well. So all those things just point to, you know, the value that companies get out of it. What we lay out in Radically Human is we talk about this framework called Ideas in the first half of the book, which is rethinking and reframing five things that we think are key to think differently about to drive the human productivity. And then the second half of the book, we talk about some of the things that we'll, we think will differentiate organizations in terms of how they move to the future.
Yeah, I want to get into the Ideas framework. I had a couple of questions about specific parts of that framework, which I think is a really, really good way to think about it. Earlier, you mentioned Moore's Law. And I'm wondering what you think is happening to Moore's Law. Is it coming to an end? Is it going to continue? Is Metcalfe's Law more important than Moore's Law today? The idea that the number of connections in the network and now the number of connections that you can make in an organization or between ideas. You mentioned people from Stockholm to you know, the United States and so on meeting in Accenture and being able to unlock that value. What's happening to Moore's Law? Is Metcalfe's Law more important? What is technology giving us these days?
Yeah, we do start to hit some limits in Moore's Law with heat dissipation and things as you get to, you know, to get to smaller and smaller pathways on the chips. There are some limits coming, but I think it almost doesn't matter as much because of other innovations that are happening. So if you look at what's happened over the last several years with GPUs, you know, graphical processing units, and the way that they can be applied to the mix and solve problems in different ways. Look at what's happening with neuromorphic chips as an example, and then you extend that and look beyond that into quantum computing.
Yeah, do you think about quantum?
Yeah, quantum, quantum computing is one of those things that I think a lot of people always say, well, it's just another 10 years away. But we're seeing, you know, the ability to use it to solve problems today. We're doing solutions in drug discovery in the pharmaceutical industry, quantum chemistry in terms of looking at analysis of new compounds and things, and other applications. So there's real world use cases of it today. And the other thing is when you look at quantum cryptography and the ability of quantum to potentially break RSA-based encryption.
I was just going to ask you about that.
It is something that you have to take seriously. The White House in the United States, the White House issued an executive order for federal agencies to be quantum safe or have a quantum safe plan. I forget the exact timeline, but in the near future. And it's because that even if quantum can't break the encryption today, the bad guys are accumulating treasure troves of stuff that they can, you know, can decrypt when quantum becomes available. So you need to, the moment to move to quantum safe cryptography is before quantum computing is ready. Similar to Y2K and is creating a similar impetus. So for those reasons, quantum computing is very interesting, and I think generalized quantum computing that can have a general purpose, you know, application to it is still a ways off. But using it for very specific problems, particularly optimization problems that are very difficult to solve using traditional techniques, we're seeing it, you know, appear today. And then you take biocomputing, DNA-based storage, other things that are probably a little further out than quantum computing. It just shows, you know, kind of a ramp of other technologies that are out there as well.
So let's talk a little bit about this framework, which I think is really distilling for managers how they should be thinking about this. And you know, you argue that in order for managers to really radically rethink how they're using these three major technologies that you talk about, cloud, AI, and metaverse, that they can think about these five key ideas that they sort of really need to change their thinking about, and that is intelligence, data, expertise, architecture, and strategy, which leads to this clever ideas,
Jim was
framework.
The clever guy. We had the five areas, and I have to give credit to my co-author. He came up with the
good job,
acronym.
Jim, that's a great framework. I appreciated that because I won't ever forget it now, and that's the point of those types of things, right? So, and communication is extremely important. So I want to dive into a few of these specifically. And let's start with, I don't want to talk about all of them, but let's start with data, because I think you make a pretty provocative statement there, because we're all chasing big data these days. And I think that that's on everybody's mind. But you argue that we need to pay attention to or be focused on small data and not just big data or maybe not big data. So what do you mean by that, and why this sort of reminder of the value of small data?
That's a good one to start with, because it, again, these five ideas things, we're trying to flip the thinking and focus a little bit in organizations. So data, the subtitle of that chapter is From Maximum to Minimum and mm-hmm. Back. Maximum being big data, minimum being very, very small data. And the point we're making is the big data is important. You can't do, if you look at the machine vision, the way we've solved that for, automated, autonomous, not autonomous, maybe not autonomous yet, but intelligent driving capabilities right. and such, and facial recognition to various things. You couldn't do that without big data. And that's it's powering the GPT transformers and DALL-E and all these amazing things that are out there. So big data has its role, but often for organizations, it's the small data that's going to be differentiating that you need to focus on. And we give an example in the book. We talk about, just think about a toddler, the first time they drop a ball. Intuitively, the toddler might not call it gravity, but a toddler will know gravity from a very early age just because of the effect of that. If you're trying to train an algorithm to understand gravity and the data you need to feed it, it'd be a very complex problem to solve in a general purpose way in the way that toddler solved it. And that's where there's new branches of AI, like common sense reasoning, that are coming into play that are very important in modeling and solving certain aspects of business, different than you would solve it with big data. And that's what we mean by, thinking of data and different techniques differently. Another example is few-shot learning is something we talk about in the book. There's some problems that you're trying to solve that there's not a lot of data to feed it. There's might be a very rare defects in a manufacturing situation where you need to train it based on, based on very rare anomalies. And there's techniques, few-shot learning that you can use to do it that way, which may be more important in your returns processing and manufacturing inspection than some of the big data.
Can you explain few-shot learning a little bit?
It's techniques that are able to draw the correlation, correlations based on much more limited instances of the mm-hmm. data. And there's even one-shot learning, which can do it, mm-hmm. Very quickly. Some of the advances in deep fake technology have been about, you can get very, very few data points about some static images of your face or my face and generate compelling videos based on, mm-hmm. on that. That would be an example of the technology being applied. In the book, we talk about the National Football League in the U.S. that's using few-shot learning to generate a lot of their game day highlights and such to find the plays that they want to select out to, produce highlights on as an example of using the technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you also talk in this framework about expertise.
Yeah.
I thought also another really interesting provocative point, you say that we should focus less on machine learning and more on machine teaching.
Right.
And so I'd love for you to explain that and to talk a little bit about what is the process of machine teaching and why is that so important?
Yeah. And this is about how you bring the human and machine together. In our first book, we talked about this idea of how do you create human superpowers by combining the human capability with the AI, because we're very good at very different things than algorithms are very good at. So how do we leverage our strengths? The emotional intelligence, the cross-domain problem solving, and things that humans are good at with the pattern detection, large data processing, and such that algorithms are good at. And that's the idea with flipping from machine learning, which is saying we learn based on data and algorithms such, to machine teaching, which is we use humans to infer and provide some of the expertise and overlay that we need in the systems. So it's about how do you provide the human in the loop input to the systems you're developing to provide that appropriate guidance. One of the examples we give is Etsy, actually, the company you probably, I don't know if you use Etsy.
Yeah,
one of these things on my wrist came from Etsy, one of the bracelets. And one thing that's very important in their case is design aesthetic in terms of understanding for the millions of items coming in, how do you make them more findable by people who have certain preferences and certain interests. Very hard for the algorithms to learn in the right way, even though they applied a lot of machine learning. But when they paired their designers with the algorithms so that the sense of design aesthetic provided as an overlay by the designers could work with the algorithms and classify and categorize to make things more findable and searchable, that had great results for them. So that's the kind of idea of how do you use the expertise you have that's uniquely human and difficult to encode in algorithms and put that together to create systems of humans and machine that solve problems that neither could solve. Radiology is another good example where people talk about the great results that algorithms can have in interpreting exams, what radiological artifacts. But when you look at the process of what's actually involved in then the end-to-end care process around those, there's a lot of human elements that are important in it. So if you look at the job of the radiologist, it's not going away. It's adapting based on how the radiologist and the software work together.
Yeah. So is it that those kinds of human-in-the-loop processes are most valuable when the decisions being made are risky, or when the decisions being made, or I should say consequential, or when the decisions being made are sort of routinized decisions? And I almost get the sense that when the machine is making decisions where the cost of an error is low, then it's maybe not the marginal value of human intervention is also low. But when getting it exactly right is important, and the machine may make errors that are very costly, that having human supervision and teaching is more important. Is that right or wrong, or is there a better way to think about it?
I think it'd be, I'd say, kind of costly, but also the value kind of dimension of it. Like in Etsy's case, that was about more
unlocking value.
Yeah, unlocking value, which is maybe the flip side. The other side of the coin from what you were talking about. So I think that's probably a good way of looking at it. And it's kind of a better use of human potential and kind of the way you kind of the roles and jobs are reshaped. There's a lot of work that's been done on this, a lot of it by the IDE, where you are on this Initiative for the Digital Economy at MIT, where that gets into this topic. Of how it works. An example is anti-money laundering, just to give another example. That's been an area where artificial intelligence and algorithms have been applied for a while to detect patterns of bad criminal activity in money flows. So you can detect money laundering, particularly across borders and in different situations. Well, it turns out that the algorithms alone have a very high false positive rate. And so when you combine it with the human expertise, you can lower the false positive rate and also get people only involved in cases where there's a real issue to be investigated, because it's kind of frustrating if you're the investigator and every time you track something down, you realize it was an anomaly that shouldn't have been flagged, and you never really apply your human skills to deliver the value that you're trained to deliver. But you really focus your activity on really tracing down and finding the illicit activity in that case. That's another example of putting the two together.
So strategy, the last one I want to talk about. Yeah. So, unpack the impacts on strategy, because I think that most managers are extremely interested in, and I think quite confused about what this means for strategy.
Yeah, this is a fascinating one for me, and it gets back to the first question you asked about the arc of kind of what's happened over the last 30 years. I think back, what strategy looked like not that long ago when clients, companies ask us to help them with their strategy was, let's spend a lot of time and let's produce a lot of stuff and let's set a 5-year strategy or 3-year, whatever it was, and let's go get the investment and let's execute on it. That generally doesn't work anymore. Business is changing so fast. The volatility, the VUCA, the volatility, uncertainty, et cetera, and the world is so high, and technology is changing so fast with this exponential technology that you need different approaches. And that's what we're writing about in the book. The other thing that makes a new approach required is that technology kind of is the business now. And I've been using this statement that every business is a technology business. We used to say every business is a digital business, which I think has become true. We said that in 2013 for the first time and kind of got criticized at the time with people saying, well, why are you talking about that? But it became kind of true that every business was, it's not really a controversial notion,
as well
accepted.
Yeah.
But the implication, I think the only problem with that statement is you miss the implication. To be good at digital, it's not just about the technology, it's business models and lots of things you do differently. But fundamentally, you got to be good at technology to be a digital leader. And I think that's now what's more in the mindset of organizations, because technology and IT aren't just the back office. It's not just about your omni-channel and channels you're creating. It's fundamentally about your product platform. Your product is becoming digital and you're creating a digital platform that might be the business itself, like we're doing for, say, lodging companies that are becoming hotel types companies that are becoming experience companies. And their product is becoming digital, not just physical. And in that future, CEOs and boards are interested in the strategy and direction, from a technology perspective more so than they were. So I spent a lot of time with CIOs, but probably as much time with CEOs talking about technology and the direction and why it's important. Mm-hmm. And therefore, you need a different approach to strategy. So we talk about three different archetypes of strategy we see. One is called forever beta, which means you just need to get started fast and iterate on it, which is maybe the Tesla type of strategy, mm-hmm. if you look at what they've done. We talk about a strategy called CoLab, which is blending scientific innovation together with technology in different ways, maybe Moderna and the way they came up with the mm-hmm. vaccine so quickly. As an example, we talk about this idea of minimum viable ideas, which is applying all five dimensions in a different way to reinvent a part of the business. And Lemonade, you know, the upstart insurance company, I think is a good example who've upended experience and expertise in the way they handle it and applied artificial intelligence, all the things we're talking about, in very innovative ways to really change the nature of the business.
Great. I want to switch gears a little bit to Web3 and talk about that. So there's been a lot of hype about Web3. I've been really diving deep into it in the last couple of years. And you're on the front line of organizational technology as it's being applied. Can you explain what the realistic near-term and long-term use cases are for blockchain, NFTs, and DAOs for modern businesses and how they'll transform the organizations of tomorrow?
Yeah, great question. The the metaverse earlier was a good lead into it because I think that is part of how the metaverse will play out. I mean, the critical layer of value in the metaverse will play out through the Web3 technologies. But they're all you've tossed a few in there, so let me break it down a little bit further. So first of all, in terms of distributed ledgers or blockchain, as we look at it, there's very good use cases today in financial markets. We're doing significant work with some financial institutions in terms of trading architectures and otherwise, where they're tokenizing their underlying products, which is makes sense for a financial related product, and using chains, in critical parts of the value chain. So common and more common in financial markets today. In supply chain, we're seeing a lot of take up of it as well. Consumer goods company we're working with that's using blockchain through their supply chain process to get multi-layer visibility. And what that means is not only knowing what my suppliers are doing, but knowing what my suppliers are and going back five or six steps in the supply chain. The only way you can do that in a trusted manner when steps two and three in the background may not want to be transparent with each other because they have a commercial relationship is with a ledger-based system that provides appropriate confidentiality with the transparency and visibility as well. So some breakthrough applications like that allows capabilities like true farm-to-fork capability, where I know my coffee bean I'm drinking was really sustainably produced and didn't destroy the rainforest.
Or to be able to find, for example, contamination events and where in the chain.
Exactly.
So there's IBM's food network food trust, I should say, that's doing that. Yeah.
So that's real. And, I think some people say, is everything moving to the blockchain? No, there's the traditional way of doing things, centralized databases and such are good for a lot of things, I think, but there's a lot of use cases where blockchain will be relevant. The challenge in getting blockchain-based models going is the ecosystem you need to build to do it. So where you have somebody with market power, with a financial market maker, for instance, they can get it going. If you have a dominant or large player in an industry, they can do it. So in a lot of cases, it's going to be about organizations getting together and building the ecosystem amongst themselves to do it. And that's probably the limiting factor right now in more blockchain adoption. Then you go to, I think the next one was NFTs and products.
Yeah, NFTs and I think FTs, DAOs and long-term and near-term. So,
I think that's an inevitability in terms of NFTs and FTs, and it's not just non-fungible products because there's fungible products that you can represent digitally. Digitally may even be a better opportunity. So we try to talk about tokenization versus NFTs and fungible tokens. It's compelling because think about a jeweler, a luxury goods manufacturer company that I was talking to recently. Right now, they sell something through a retail store. They don't know who bought it, and it's sold. They make their money through the value chain, but no end customer relationship, really. Mm-hmm. Think about in a world where you can create a digital analog of that product that has some value to the customer. It could be everything from warranty to attestation of the product to other services that you kind of wrap in with it. And now you have the ability to re-intermediate yourself to the customer, kind of like some of their early digital ideas that were talked about and done in other ways. I think that's real potential and a real big opportunity for many organizations as they go forward. I'm a little skeptical in some of the current NFT approaches because I think the idea of creating artificial scarcity as a means to promote a market. It works for some things. I don't think that's a generalized economic model that a lot of organizations should follow. To me, it's more less about creating artificial scarcity, more about creating durable digital relationships with customers in a compelling new way. Mm-hmm. A key thing that's going to unlock and enable more of that to happen is going to be new advances that are happening in things like the Open Wallet Foundation, which if your listeners don't know about it, it's a good thing to explore, which is Lytx Foundation bringing a lot of organizations together, Accenture, MasterCard, many organizations, to create a portable and trusted standard for a wallet that can house your NFTs. It could also house your identity, so it can be game-changing for things like KYC processes in the financial services industry.
Know your customer.
Yeah, and to me, that's one of the that's kind of a signpost for what as that comes for the real take up of everything we're talking about. And then the other signpost is watching what happens with fiat-based currencies. The digital dollar, for example, which is a which is something that's underway that we're involved with as well, the analog in many other countries. 105 central banks, the central banks of 105 countries around the world, are pursuing digital fiat currencies. That represents 95% of the currency in circulation today. And as you have programmable fiat currencies, I think we get into a much different and much more interesting discussion about how you then wrap products around them and how you use them to create innovative
products. Give me some examples, because that's fascinating.
Well, the think about an example application for disaster relief in the let's take the U.S. as an example. What if it was possible to give a certain set of aid to only those people affected by a disaster so that they could only buy critical products that were needed for their recovery? Really tightly control the supply of money to go to the problem source.
I'm going to give you some digital funds that are restricted in use and actually give you exclusive access to that kind of relief and can only use it in
and you
that
know,
way.
You know it got example. To the right source or the right
and
destination.
They're using it for the right
and you
reason.
You know it got used in the right way. Just an example.
Think about how many, was it PPP loans during COVID that were sort of like wasted on companies that didn't need them or wasted for things that weren't intended for.
And the one-time complexity of building these PPP systems and everything around it for the government and banks and everything else. So I think that's an example. There's many other examples like that. And the idea of right now where you have DeFi, decentralized finance happening around chains, crypto chains generally. Mm-hmm. Think about DeFi in the context of enabling financial services around fiat currencies and things like that. And that's, I think, very exciting. So that's that whole category. Yeah. And I think those are the signposts there, watching the fiat currencies and watching the open wallet and standardization. And then the DAOs, I don't know. I just have to say there's some things that I'll have a strong opinion on. I've given you some of them today. DAOs, I'm not sure about. I think it's a super interesting mechanism for doing certain types of things. Some of the investing DAOs that I've seen, I think, are interesting. Is it a sustainable, really scalable model that really is the new way of doing the internet in a decentralized way? I'm not sure. I know many believe that. I'm not sure because the skeptic in me sees a lot of return to large centralized organizations, even as we look to Web3. If you look to the Coinbases and platform companies that are providing a lot of the Web3 capability. And I think there's something provided by centralized platforms in terms of consumer interface, in terms of regulatory ability, which is important, and accountability, that will be tough to do in that world. So to me, it's a question of what roles will the DAOs play? And I don't really see a scenario where that is the future and everything's a DAO, but they probably have an important role to play as you look at some of the models being tested right now.
Yeah. So if you look at transaction cost economics, and if you only saw that as the driving force, you would see, you would think that these kinds of technologies would actually shrink the boundary of the firm and move more things into the market, because the idea is that these kinds of technologies, verifiability and trust and transparency and so on and so forth, are going to reduce the transaction costs of market-based transactions.
Right.
And that is the whole reason, multiple Nobel Prizes were won on the theory that that's why you have organizations, is because the cost of transacting is so high that you want to bring it into a employee-employer relationship, solve the principal-agent problem, and that all happens. And, the job that someone is going to do is so complex that you can't, write down every single thing they're going to do and how they're going to be judged. And so you want that in a contractual employment relationship. But if transaction costs go down so dramatically with this technology, do you think we're going to see firms shrink in size and have more market transactions, or do you think we're going to see firms get bigger and maybe implement some of that inside the firm and sort of micro economies within the firm?
Yeah, I'm debating some of this with my team. I have a very, very similar debate right now. As we look at this and do some research around it, theoretically it should reduce the firm, so to speak, and because of some of the decreasing transaction costs that you can get external to the organizations. Don't know though; the jury's still out on whether that's really how it plays out. I think the question is kind of where can you make those models work, and are there organizations who employ those models? I think will be an interesting thing to look at as well. Is there a way for for companies and organizations to employ that for part of the ways they run their processes, so it becomes almost customer governed in many ways. I think there's some interesting potential there too.
So I've heard about this this sort of trilemma of Web3, which is that you can have security, decentralization, and scalability, but you can only have two of those three. You can't have all three of them. Is that true, do you think, or do you think that there are ways to have all three?
It depends on what you mean by security. I think the security and decentralization, I think you can get a technical level of security, in terms of protecting core data and things like that. I think it gets hard to provide, kind of the accountability you talked about earlier, and some of the recourse that you might want to have in the economic structures with consumers and citizens and such, and then the accountability at the end of the day. So I think it's tough to get the balance on all three of those right. I think technically, can you scale it and scale decentralize and some base of security? Probably, I think as you go, there's some interesting models that the scale and the decentralize has some challenges right now, as you know, if you're watching the experience play out, but that's some of that probably will be solved. I think to me, it's more about how do we want to administer these and what kinds of organizations will consumers broadly want to interact with as they go forward. One thing we haven't talked about that is so much at the foundation of my thinking of this that I'll just mention it because
it's
relevant on this topic is the idea of trust. And I think we can design the best systems for doing a lot of this stuff, but if it's not trusted, it's not going to go anywhere, especially because I think there's a lot of trust gaps right now because of what's happening with social media and all the different questions around fake news and different things that are being debated so vociferously. So I think one of the things that organizations need to pay a lot more attention to, and those propagating some of these models need to pay attention to, is how are you going to create the trust that people are going to want to use your model. So if I'm going to create a new AI powered customer care capability, leveraging the ideas framework for my company.
From the book.
Will customers trust it? Because the power of it's going to be my ability to provide deeper services that are more personalized to the customer. To do that, I need more data and interaction with the customer, maybe more continuously. I need to be more part of their life, so to speak. If I'm going to do in-home grocery delivery or whatever it might be, through that type of experience. So I think I don't think organizations have really focused enough on that and gotten their mind wrapped around it. So we tried to focus a lot on that. That's one of the chapters near the end of Radically Human, and it was in the first book as well, is trust, I think, really becomes a differentiator. A lot of people say data is the new currency of the economy or data is the new oil or whatever. I think it's trust. I think trust is going to be the thing that really differentiates companies as we go forward.
So I want to end with a question that's a little bit more broad and personal. So you have a storied career in this industry, and for people starting out in technology or really in business or some combination, what advice would you give for someone early on in their career for how to really do things in a way that's going to consistently give them a leg up or an edge or a way of looking at things to keep themselves current, to keep themselves sharp in this game?
Yeah, I talk about three things. That boils down to three words: live, learn, and teach. Is the way I would frame it. Live is about pursuing your personal passion. I think if you want to be excellent at something, it's got to be consistent with your values. You got to love doing it, and it's got to be core to what you do. And you need to make sure that what you're doing is consistent with your personal values and your family values and what you deeply value. I think the whole idea of being kind of purpose-driven and centered. So, and you have to think about your own wellness and well-being as part of that. So the idea of being centered, being, you know, thinking about your purpose and connecting that to the work you do, I think is really important. And that's one thing I'd say, you know, pursuing your passion. And, you know, for me, I'm having more fun now than I was having, you know, when I started 36 years ago, because it's, this is kind of just kind of what I do and what I like to do. The second is learn. And I don't think it's just true in tech. I think this is true of every industry. It's about, learning. How do you become an active learner? I think to be successful today and to, you know, to be effective, you have to be a learner. I think it's a human thing. Humans like to learn. That's what we do, you know. So thinking about your own learning architecture, that's the way I think about it. I'm an engineer, so I think about architecture. So I have my architecture that I kind of have on a piece of paper of blogs and books and topics and hands-on things I do. And I challenge myself at the end of every day, what did I learn? Did I learn something? And sometimes I set a learning challenge at the start of the day. I'm going to go learn about this. So I think being a learner is really important. And then the third thing is teach. And that's the way I've always thought about leadership. I never wanted to do anything other than my own research. I wanted to go off and I'd been happy. I thought as my younger self, just sitting in a room doing compiler and language theory. But I really, as I got into it, I embraced leadership because I framed it as teaching and getting people aligned with the vision, which is a little bit about that live and learn, and then teaching, you know, teaching people to do more, teaching people the values and the vision, and making them removing the roadblocks for them to be effective. So live, learn, and teach is the advice I give people.
I love it, Paul. Thank you very much. This has been enlightening, fascinating, and I know you're extremely busy, so we really appreciate your time, and thanks for stopping by and having this chat with us.
It's been so much fun. Thanks for having me.
The Digital Insider with Sanon Aral is brought to you by the MIT Initiative on the Digital Economy, hosted by Sanon Aral, produced and edited by Carrie Reynolds. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Share today's episode and tag us on social media at MIT_IDE. To leave a voicemail for Sanon for the chance to have your question answered live on air in a future episode, call 617-468-8423, or you can email mitdigitalinsider@gmail.com. Visit our website, ide.mit.edu/podcast, for more.